from deep inside your radio.
We may have a dead mouse in the studio. Not the rodent kind. Not rodentally speaking. Ladies and gentlemen, you know, if you've been listening to this broadcast for any length of time, and if you have, thanks so very much, that I'm kind of hung up on matters of language from time to time, the whole initial so thing that has. Thank you, folks, that are now tweeting me saying, I can't listen to interviewees now because I'm so sensitized to their use of the word so. It may be working, or maybe you're just not sending me enough examples right now because it seems to have, the flow of so's from the listeners seems to have waned in the last couple of weeks. But we'll get back to it. Anyway, something else occurs to me. I'm not going to make a big thing out of a week after week, drawing the ire of the San Diego desk, but I will point it out. The way things are going, ladies and gentlemen, by my observation, in about 100, 200 years as these things evolve, the sound of the letter S in the English language will have disappeared. I know that's a shocking and radical thing to say on the radio, but bear me out. In England and Australia, or Britain and Australia, I've noticed that very educated people, this is all about educated people now, at least as I hear them on the radio and television, when an S comes before the letter U, it becomes an SH. I presume a consumer. It's not a Barbara Walters thing or a Tom Brokaw thing. It's like normal people. I presume. Okay, so that's over there. What about here? I was flying back from London this week, and I was listening to the safety video. The safety video, now introduced, as they all are, by the head of the airline, wasting a minute of your time bragging on how great the airline. I'm already flying in your airline, bud. You don't have to advertise it. But, you know, once they put something on video, there's a smart person somewhere in the company who says, hey, you know, as long as it's on video, why don't we put a commercial in front of it? For us! It's win-win. Anyway, the narratress, did I just make that up, of the safety video, refers repeatedly to strapping your belt, your strap, you know, across your lap, the strap of your seatbelt, and structure. I don't remember where she uses the word structure, but I've heard that a lot. Structure and strap, when the S comes before a hard consonant, it goes SH on us. It goes all SH on our behinds. So just, you know, tell your grandchildren there once was a letter called S. Speaking of traveling back to the United States, last time I did it, as this time, I flew through wonderful Hartsfield Airport in Atlanta, the world's largest. What a thing to be proud of. It means the crowds are the world's largest. And I asked the question, why, if you've been through security to get on the plane in the first place, you get off the plane, you go nowhere except to try to catch your next flight, your connecting flight, and they make you go through security again. Now, many listeners have pointed out, oh, well, but you've been forced by customs to claim your checked bags, and you've touched your checked bags, maybe something from your checked bag you've moved into your carry-on, and that wouldn't be allowed. Interesting point. In the front end, you know, where you're buying your tickets and stuff and checking in, you know what? They have separate lines for people with no checked bags. But more to the point, this inside information from one of our desks, and I'm going to obscure the name of the airline in this country to protect the source. But one of our major airlines in this country has a deal with British Airways that you do not have to do double check-in at O'Hare Airport in Chicago. It's a deal. Now, it so happens both legs of my flights from London to New Orleans are on the same airline, so Delta could make a deal with itself. So on this particular airline at O'Hare, you go to customs, go from customs to secure bus to secure area, so you never get insecure. O'Hare, I'm reportedly told, also has a deal with Canada and Dublin's airport that you do not have to do double TSA. It's a deal, ladies and gentlemen. It's just a deal. See? And last week, I told you about the amount of food that's wasted every year in Britain. But you're here. You're in the United States. So United States Department of Agriculture, we learned this week, estimates that 31% of the American food supply is lost and uneaten. A report from the USDA's Economic Research Service finds the United States 31% of the 430 billion pounds of the available food supply at the retail and consumer levels in 2010 went uneaten. The estimated value of this food loss, $161 billion at retail. 141 trillion calories lost in 2010, or 1,200 calories per capita per day. And still we're obese. How does that happen? Hello. Welcome to the show.
Say the writing's on the wall. I could not see it till today. You made such fools out of us all. It took me a long time, but now I see through every part you play, 'cause you're always a victim. So goes your story. Your pains and your worries seem to wither and bend. Don't play me your sad song. I've seen you turn when you want to. Don't tell me your secrets. You are not my. Behind it all, tea and sympathy. But watch out when the hammer falls, 'cause you're always a victim. So goes your story. Your pain and your glories seem to weave and bend. Don't play me your sad songs. I've seen you turn when you want to. Tell me your secrets. You are not my friend. No, 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 no. You are not my friend.
From the edge of Lake Pontchartrain in New Orleans, Louisiana, I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of the show. And now, ladies and gentlemen, news from outside the bubble. From the Telegraph in London, Tony Blair knew in detail about the CIA's secret kidnap and interrogation program after 9/11, was kept informed every step of the way by his own version of the CIA, MI6. That's according to a security source for the Telegraph. Blair, then Prime Minister and then his foreign secretary, were fully briefed on CIA activities and were shown now infamous Bush administration legal opinions that declared enhanced interrogation techniques, such as waterboarding, to be illegal. The politicians took a very active interest indeed. They wanted to know everything. The Americans passed over the legal opinion saying that this was now legal, and our politicians were aware of what was going on. The politicians knew in detail about everything, the torture and the rendition, said the source, who has direct and detailed knowledge of transatlantic relations during that period and used the word torture. Quote, they could have said to MI6, stop it, do not get involved, but at no time did they. The claims come as Scotland Yard, that's the police, continues to investigate whether MI6 officers should face criminal charges for alleged complicity in the rendition of suspected terrorists, including two Libyan Islamists who were sent back in 2004 to Gaddafi's Libya, where they were tortured. The Telegraph understands that MI6 has been forced to hand over top secret documents from that period to police, and that senior officers who served at the time have been interviewed as part of the investigation. That's right. In Britain, national security is not threatened by investigations of torture. Memo to President Obama. News from outside the bubble, ladies and gentlemen. A copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And now...
Once I had a secret that lived within the heart of me. All too soon, my secret became impatient to be free. And my secret's no secret anymore.
News of secrets. Other secrets now, for your listening pleasure. The U.S. National Security Agency knew for at least 2 years about the Heartbleed flaw in Internet security. The agency's reported, this according to Bloomberg News, the agency's reported decision to keep the bug secret in pursuit of national security interests threatens to renew the rancorous debate over the role of the government's top computer experts. The NSA, during that two-year period, regularly used the flaw to gather critical intelligence, two people familiar with the matter said. But the NSA, after declining to comment on this report originally, has subsequently denied it was aware of Heartbleed until the vulnerability was made public earlier this month. So the NSA is actually denying, as opposed to refusing to comment, which means what? Meanwhile, McClatchy Newspapers has gotten hold somehow of the conclusions and a lot of the material in the still classified Senate Intelligence Committee report on all of the CIA adventures, an act which has Senator Dianne Feinstein, chairman of the Intelligence Committee, calling on the Justice Department to investigate not the CIA, McClatchy Newspapers. Here's their report, or here's one of their reports, a still secret Senate Intelligence Committee report calls into question the legal foundation of the CIA's use of waterboarding and other harsh interrogation techniques, a finding that challenges the key defense on which the agency and the Bush administration relied in arguing that the methods didn't constitute torture. The report also found the spy agency failed to keep an accurate account of the number of individuals it held, and it issued erroneous claims about how many it detained and subjected to the controversial interrogation methods. CIA claimed about 30 detainees underwent these techniques. The CIA's claim, quote, is BS, unquote, according to a former U.S. official familiar with the evidence underpinning the report. They're trying to minimize the damage. They're trying to say it was a very targeted program, but that's not the case, unquote. Some of the report's other conclusions obtained by McClatchy, the CIA used interrogation methods that weren't approved by the Justice Department. The agency impeded effective White House oversight and decision-making regarding the program. The CIA actively evaded or impeded congressional oversight of the program. The agency hindered oversight of the program by its own inspector general. Aside from that, Mrs. Lincoln, it didn't impede nothing. The investigation determined the program produced very little intelligence of value and that the CIA misled the Bush White House, the Congress, and the public about the effectiveness of the techniques, which include waterboarding, sleep deprivation for up to 11 days, confinement in a cramped box, and slamming detainees into walls. But they were soft walls. The CIA agreed with some of the report's findings but disputed other conclusions in its official response last year. The Justice Department Office of Legal Counsel found that the methods wouldn't breach the law because those applying them didn't have the specific intent of inflicting severe pain or suffering. The Senate report concluded, however, that the Justice Department's legal analyses were based on flawed information provided by the CIA, which prevented a proper evaluation of the program's legality. Quote, the CIA repeatedly provided inaccurate information to the Department of Justice, impeding a proper legal analysis of the CIA's detention and interrogation program. The CIA personnel used interrogation methods that were never approved by the Justice Department or their own headquarters. The conclusion CIA provided inaccurate information to DOJ reflects the findings of a top secret investigation of the program by the CIA's own Inspector General's office. That report, May 7, 2004, which was declassified, found in waterboarding Abu Zubaydah and Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, deemed the chief architect of 9/11, the CIA went beyond the parameters it outlined to the Office of Legal Counsel, which wrote the legal opinions. Zubaydah was waterboarded 82 times, Mohammed 183. These cases clashed with the CIA's assertion, outlined in the now declassified John Yoo legal opinion, that repetition of the methods, quote, will not be substantial because the techniques generally lose their effectiveness after several repetitions, unquote. The Office of Legal Counsel opinion at the time stated that the finding that the techniques didn't constitute torture was based on facts provided by the CIA, and that, quote, if these facts were to change, this advice would not necessarily apply, unquote. Because he's a lawyer. Don't you know? Helping the Obama administration to decide what parts of the Senate committee's report should be declassified and made public. Say it with me. The CIA. More secret, more from that McClatchy report. The CIA's use of harsh interrogation techniques was more widespread than the agency public acknowledged. And the CIA's own internal documents confirm the agency's culpability in the hypothermia death of one Afghan captive, an incident that has never even been publicly discussed. So that's one death, at least. McClatchy's sources differed on the actual number of detainees who endured the techniques. One former official said a majority of the 100 detainees were subjected to the various tactics and confirmed the CIA's account that only three were waterboarded. Another current official said it was not accurate to say that virtually all the detainees were subjected to the techniques, but described their use as widespread. There will be a lot of things in these report, in this report, these sections of these reports, that will be upsetting to people to read, said a former U.S. official, but it would make it impossible for the United States to argue that this was defensible, he added. Other news of secrets? It's not just us. The federal government of Australia has successfully blocked the release of secret archives that would reveal Australian knowledge of Indonesian war crimes in East Timor, arguing that relations with Indonesia are presently too strained to cope with the potential embarrassment for both countries. Administrative Appeals Tribunal President Justice Duncan Kah said the National Archives was right to deny a professor access to Australian diplomatic papers from more than 32 years ago. The professor, Clinton Fernandez, has been engaged in a six-year bureaucratic and legal struggle to secure declassification of records relating to Indonesia's invasion and occupation of East Timor. Did you even know that happened? Did that bother us at all that that happened and the war crimes occurred? Does it bother us that war crimes, according to the United Nations, or crimes against humanity, pardon me, are now occurring in Burma against an ethnic minority there? Nah. The operation in Indonesia in late 1981 and early 1982, hey, Reagan was in. He cared so much about Grenada. Involved the Indonesian army using East Timorese civilians as human shields and ended with a massacre of hundreds of people. News of secrets, ladies and gentlemen. Because some secrets are secrets no more. It's a new and newly copyrighted, that is to say, not copyrighted at all, feature of this broadcast. And now, News of the Warm, won't you? One-time award-winning News of the Warm.
Soft, listen to the warm. We can listen to the warm.
Yes, we can. For the first time, a field test has demonstrated that elevated levels of carbon dioxide inhibit the ability of plants to assimilate nitrate into proteins, indicating the nutritional quality of food crops is at risk as climate change intensifies. These findings were reported in the journal Nature Climate Change. See, nature has a vested interest in climate change, otherwise that magazine goes out of business. Quote, food quality is declining under the rising levels of atmospheric carbon dioxide we are experiencing, said the lead author, Arnold Bloom. Several explanations for this decline have been put forward, but this is the first study to demonstrate that elevated carbon dioxide inhibits the conversion of nitrate into protein in a crop grown out in the field. The assimilation or processing of nitrogen plays a key role, is all, in the plant's growth and productivity. In food crops, it's especially important because plants use nitrogen to produce the proteins that are vital for human nutrition. Wheat, particularly, provides nearly one-fourth of all protein in the global human diet. Eat more cows, then. Many previous laboratory studies have demonstrated that elevated levels of atmospheric carbon dioxide inhibited nitrate assimilation in the leaves of grain and non-legume plants. However, there had been no verification of this relationship in plants grown out in the field. But these researchers examined samples of wheat that had been grown in a Maricopa agricultural center near Phoenix, hence the name Maricopa. Analysis of temperature data since 1500 virtually... virtually rules out the possibility that global warming in the industrial era is just a natural fluctuation in the Earth's climate, according to a new study reported by McGill University physics professor Sean Lovejoy. It's a new approach to the question of whether global warming in the industrial era has been caused largely by man-made emissions or not. Rather than using complex computer models to estimate the effects of greenhouse gas emissions, Lovejoy examines historical data to assess the hypothesis that warming over the past century is due, that warming over the past century is due to natural long-term variations in temperature. This study will be a blow to any remaining climate change deniers, Lovejoy says. Their two most convincing arguments, that the warming is natural in origin and that the computer models are wrong, are either directly contradicted by this analysis or simply do not apply to it. And scientific uncertainty has been described as a monster that prevents understanding and delays mitigative action in responding to climate change, even after the IPCC issued another alarming report this week. New research by Professor Stephen Lewandowski of the University of Bristol. They have a university in Bristol? And international colleagues shows that uncertainty should make us more rather than less concerned about climate change, says Science Daily. In two companion papers published in Climatic Change, they would go out of business, that publication. The researchers investigated the mathematics of uncertainty in the climate system and showed that increased scientific uncertainty necessitates even greater action to mitigate climate change. The scientists used an ordinal approach, a range of mathematical methods that address the question, what would the consequences be if uncertainty is even greater than we think it is? They showed that as uncertainty in the temperature increase expected with a doubling of CO2 rises, so do the economic damages of increased climate change. Greater uncertainty also increases the likelihood of exceeding safe temperature levels and the probability of failing to reach mitigation targets. That's what they've proved. It's News of the Warm, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And now, what the frack? I almost went into a News of AFPAC vocalese there and stopped myself just in time because it would have been wrong. I could have done it, you know, but it would have been wrong. So, as I say now, what the frack? Whether or not fracking causes groundwater pollution, people fear the risk enough that property values have dropped for homes with drinking water wells near shale gas drilling, according to new research published by Forbes. Researchers from the University of Calgary, and Duke University studied property sales from 1994 to 2012 in 36 Pennsylvania counties and 7 counties in New York. They mapped sales against the location of shale gas wells, and they compared homes connected to public drinking water systems to homes with private wells. Properties with private wells, you remember him, he served in the, suffered a loss in value compared to properties connected to a municipal water system, they found, offsetting gains in value from royalties paid to the homeowners for mineral rights, just in case the oil companies are still paying those royalties. So you get the royalties, but you lose your property value. But so that all that means is you have to stay put, don't it? And recent small earthquakes in Ohio were likely triggered by fracking, Ohio state regulators said this week. It's a new link that could have implications for oil and gas drilling in the Buckeye State and beyond. In the strongest wording yet from the state linking energy drilling and quakes, the Ohio Department of Natural Resources said that injecting sand, water, and chemicals deep underground to help release oil and gas may have produced tremors in Poland Township last month. Pause for, you know, the requisite jokes. The statement in which the department announced stricter rules for oil and gas exploration in areas where seismic activity has already occurred, well, that would be closing the barn door, comes after a steep rise in earthquakes in Ohio and other states where intense drilling has taken place. Most earthquakes occur naturally, but scientists have long linked some smaller tremors to oil and gas work underground, which can alter pressure points, you know, like the Chinese. No, actually, seriously, the Chinese are doing an awful lot of fracking right about now. Last month, drilling and fracking was suspended near the site of two earthquakes in Poland Township, southeast of Cleveland, the first of which was magnitude 3.0. Earthquakes rattled residents in Oklahoma last weekend, the latest in a series that had put the state on track for record earthquakes, as we repeated here last week. Regarding the seismic events in Poland Township, ODNR, Ohio geologists, believe the sand and water injected into the well during the hydraulic fracturing process may have increased pressure on an unknown microfault in the area. This is a state, by the way, with a Republican governor who is dabbling with the idea of running for president. Not as crazy as Bobby Jindal, but still. The statement could have impact not just for Ohio, but in other regions where concerns have emerged about the impact of fracking on fault lines. The new rules require a company to install seismic monitors if it's drilling within 3 miles of a known fault. Of course, the Poland case, I think, I just said was previously unknown fault, or an area which has recently experienced quakes. It's unclear how much drilling will be affected by the new rules. Hillcorp Energy, the company was drilling near the quakes, can't resume operations until it submits a new plan convincing regulators that drilling is safe. That'll be compelling reading. The department had not previously linked earthquakes to fracking, but the new data gives it reasonable certainty that fracking was the cause. So I think this means, given the report in Forbes, we won't be able to sell Ohio for a little while. Value has gone down. Talking dirty behind my back, and I know that.
back, and I know that some do. Please, won't you, please, won't you bear in mind? Love is a lesson to learn in our time. Please, won't you bear it in mind for me? May I never lay a head down without a hand to hold. Behind my back, and I know there's those that do. Oh, please, won't you, please, won't you bear it in mind? Love is a lesson to learn in our time. Oh, please, won't you bear it in mind for me? May I never lose your temper if you get in a barroom fight.
This is Le Show. Ladies and gentlemen, you probably have noticed that over the weekend, new reports heating up the story in Ukraine. On Saturday, people variously described as activists or Russian thugs, Russian pro-Russian activists or militants, a lot of different descriptions. Anyway, they're armed, masked, looking a lot like the similar guys who were active in the takeover in the build up to the Russian annexation of Crimea a few weeks ago. They on Saturday occupied a police station and a couple other government buildings in eastern Ukraine, and on Sunday the Ukrainian government said it was undertaking an anti-terrorism operation. And at least one person has already been killed. A lot of angry words from Washington. And returning to his proper form, Senator John McCain appeared on a Sunday morning Yak show saying the United States wasn't doing enough. And we should be sending arms to the Ukrainian army. Now, there are 40,000 Russian troops on the other side of the Ukrainian border. And he wasn't asked, well, how many arms do we need to send to enable the Ukrainian army, outnumbered 6-1, to beat that? He wasn't asked that question. But he's going back to Ukraine. So that'll fix everything. Now, because people are going to jump to conclusions, let me say for the record, like somebody's keeping a record of this, it's a radio program. It goes away. But for the record, Vladimir Putin, ex-CIA, ex-KGB agent, Vladimir Putin is not the nicest guy in the world. He's probably not a real believer in democracy. I know that some people like him.
But when I was asked a question, do you trust Vladimir Putin, in front of a huge press conference after our meeting, my answer was yes. I could have tried to be clever like Ronald Reagan, who had the great answer, trust but verify, but that would have sounded like plagiarism. And so I said, Yes, and the reporter said, why? And I said, because I looked into his eyes and I saw his soul.
Ugh. Anyway, so that being said, you may remember, ladies and gentlemen, there was a tape recording of a telephone conversation that went viral in February before the Ukrainian government was overthrown. The elected Ukrainian government was overthrown. The elected Ukrainian government, whose leader had recently rebuffed approaches by the EU to throw his lot in with a Russian plan for an alternative economic union involving the former Soviet republics. The thing that made the news was this was a conversation between Victoria Nuland, an assistant secretary of state, and the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, Jeffrey Pyatt. And what made the news was that she uttered a profanity with regard to the European Union. And that was really all we knew. You know, it turned out that phone conversation had been monitored and recorded, supposedly by the Russians, and released to YouTube, supposedly by the Russians. The U.S. never denied the accuracy of the report. It just denounced the release of the recording. It just denounced the release of it. And it wasn't until a couple of days ago when a listener alerted me to listen to the entirety, not just the profanity, but the entirety of the recording, that I went back and did so. And without explaining anything more than this is Victoria Nuland, Assistant Secretary of State, on the phone with the U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine sometime before the overthrow of the then-elected Ukrainian government and its replacement. And I'll explain only that she refers to Klitsch, who is Vladimir Klitschko, a former wrestler, now tipped as one of the candidates in an upcoming presidential election in Ukraine. And Yats is a shorthand for the full name, which I forget at this moment, of the current unelected president of Ukraine. I think that's all you need to know. Here's the conversation.
What do you think?
I think we're in play. The Klitschko piece is obviously the complicated electron here, especially the announcement of him as deputy prime minister. And you've seen some of my notes on the troubles in the marriage right now, so we're trying to get a read really fast on where he is on this stuff. But I think your argument to him, which you'll need to make, I think that's the next phone call we want to set up, is exactly the one you made to Yats. And I'm glad you sort of put him on the spot on where he fits in this scenario. And I'm very glad he said what he said in response.
Good. So I don't think Klitsch should go into the government. I don't think it's necessary. I don't think it's a good idea.
Yeah, I mean, I guess you think in terms of him not going into the government, just let him sort of stay out and do his political homework and stuff. I'm just thinking in terms of sort of the process moving ahead, we want to keep the moderate Democrats together. The problem is going to be Tanibok and his guys. And, you know, I'm sure that's part of what Yanukovych is calculating on all of this.
I think Yats is the guy who's got the economic experience, the governing experience. He's the guy, you know, what he needs is Klitsch and Tanibok on the outside. He needs to be talking to them four times a week, you know. I just think Klitsch going in, he's going to be at that level working for Yatsenyuk. It's just not going to work.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. Okay. Good. Well, do you want us to try to set up a call with him as the next step?
My understanding from that call, but you tell me, was that the big three were going into their own meeting and that Yats was going to offer in that context a three-way, you know, the three-plus-one conversation or three-plus-two with you. Is that not how you understood it?
No, I mean, that's what he proposed, but I think just knowing the dynamic that's been with them where Klitschko has been the top dog. He's going to take a while to show up for whatever meeting they've got, and he's probably talking to his guys at this point. So I think you reaching out directly to him helps with the personality management among the three, and it gives you also a chance to move fast on all this stuff and put us behind it before they all sit down and he explains why he doesn't like it.
Okay, good. I'm happy. Why don't you reach out to him and see if he wants to talk before or after?
Okay, will do. Thanks.
Okay, I've now written, one more wrinkle for you, Jeff.
Yeah.
can't remember if I told you this or if I only told Washington this, that when I talked to Jeff Feltman this morning, he had a new name for the UN guy, Robert Seri. Did I write you that this morning?
Yeah, okay. I saw that.
He's now gotten both Seri and Ban Ki-moon to agree that Seri could come in Monday or Tuesday.
Okay.
So that would be great, I think, to help glue this thing and have the UN help glue it and, you know, f*** the EU.
No, exactly. And I think we've got to do something to make it stick together, because you can be pretty sure that if it does start to gain altitude, the Russians will be working behind the scenes to try to torpedo it. And again, the fact that this is out there right now, I'm still trying to figure out in my mind why Yanukovych did that. But in the meantime, there's a Party of Regions faction meeting going on right now, and I'm sure there's a lively argument going on in that group at this point. But anyway, we could land jelly set up on this one if we move fast. So let me work on Klitschko, and if you can just keep, I think we want to try to get somebody with an international personality to come out here and help to midwife this thing. And then the other issue is some kind of outreach to Yanukovych, but we probably regroup on that tomorrow as we see how things start to fall into place.
So on that piece, Jeff, when I wrote the note, Sullivan's come back to me, VFR, saying you need Biden, and I said probably tomorrow for an attaboy and to get the deets to stick. So
okay.
Biden's willing.
Okay, great.
All right.
Thanks.
Now, if you're bad old Vladimir and you hear a secret recording of U.S. diplomats discussing gluing this thing and midwifing this thing, what do you think? Now, ladies and gentlemen, let's follow the dollar. A set of laws unique to Louisiana allows the state to claim the minerals found underneath any navigable body of water. This is a report from Al Jazeera America, not seen in your area. That has troubling implications for landowners in every coastal region of the state. You know that Louisiana is losing coastal land as land subsides and sea level rises. That's the meaning behind that lawsuit by the Orleans East Bank Levy Authority we've discussed in this program. So the laws mean, and that lawsuit has been blocked, or is being attempted to be blocked, by the governor of Louisiana, Bobby Jindal. And assumption has been, well, he's funded by the oil guys. Well, the Al Jazeera report says the law means that as more land becomes submerged under the waters of the Gulf of Mexico each year, more and more money that once flowed from oil and gas drilling companies to the bank accounts of landowners now will flow directly into the coffers of the state of Louisiana. Landowners say this creates a disincentive for Louisiana's government to care about coastal areas and repair and maintain wetlands. The theory goes that if the cash-strapped state can make money off gaining increased mineral rights, then it has no reason to help keep privately owned bayou property from going underwater. This is one of many laws inherited by Louisiana from the French, giving the state ownership of any navigable waterways, which are defined as places where boats could theoretically pass during the high tide of winter months. Louisiana law also links land ownership to the ownership of minerals underneath. These laws create problems in Louisiana, where wetlands are practically everywhere, mostly privately owned and rapidly disappearing. Roughly the size of Delaware is what Louisiana has lost. As global warming increases and water moves inland, what's considered a navigable water body will change, says a law professor at Tulane, but the state may be claiming more now. People care about the land a lot more once there's money involved. And following the dollar, still further, while a majority of jobs lost during the Great Recession were in the middle range of wages, a majority of those added during the recovery have been low-paying, according to a report from the National Employment Law Project. The disappearance of mid-wage, mid-skill jobs is part of a longer-term trend, says a writer for the New York Times, that some refer to as a hollowing out of the workforce, probably accelerated by government layoffs. The overarching message is we don't just have a jobs deficit, we have a good jobs deficit, said a the author of the report and a co-director of the National Employment Law Project, a liberal research group. The middle third of occupations accounted for 60% of job losses from 2008 to early 2010. Those fields have represented only 22% of total job growth. The occupations with the fastest growth were retail sales and food preparation. Some of these new lower-paying jobs are being taken by people just entering the labor force, but many are being filled by older workers who lost more lucrative jobs in the recession and were forced to take something to scrape by. Conclusion from this and many other indices is the great middle class that grew up in the aftermath of World War II may be a thing of the past.
Split level in the suburbs, the good old 9 to 5. In the eyes of the hipperati, you were barely alive. Completely college educated, retirement fully planned. Taste was always on the inner boundary, point of view safely bland. So above you, sauteed you in sass. Whatever became of you, Mr. Middle Class? And beehives, a future in your Ford. Protest was for commies, silence was its own reward. Stiff and square, flagpole up your ass. But we know what became of you, Mr. Middle Class.
Mm-hmm. And now, news of the Olympic movement. Produced by Jim Ebersole Jr. Dateline Rio de Janeiro. Rio's attempts to clean the waters where Olympic sailing events will be held just a couple of years are so far behind schedule, cleanup efforts are now stopgap rather than lasting, local officials admitted this week. Quote, cleaning rubbish from the Guanabara Bay will be a stopgap effort, according to Carlos Portillo, the state's subsecretary for the environment, but it's what we have to do. Portillo took office this week and is charged with cleaning the bay's notoriously fetid waters. He criticized the urban districts that surround the bay for contributing to the pollution. Quote, the municipalities are on the coast of the Guanabara Bay, and they don't think the rubbish thrown in the bay is their responsibility, he said. Sounds like people, doesn't it? Portillo said tenders for 7 ecobats that will skim garbage from the water surface and 9 eco-barriers designed to keep rubbish from flowing into the bay from tributaries are scheduled to take place this month. They'll go out for bid. You make an ecobat? Hundreds of millions of dollars have already been spent on cleaning the bay, much of it from foreign donors, but the situation remains critical. The bay is an integral part of Rio's topography. Tourists to the city who cross the bay when driving in from the international airport are greeted by a stench. Sailors have expressed disgust at the high level of coliforms and other pollutants. Reuters reporters who sailed on the bay last month came across all sorts of floating debris, including an old sofa. Sofa surfing, everybody! When the right to host the games, Rio promised it would treat 80% of the sewage water flowing into the bay by the time the games start. Almost 5 years later, only half that target has been reached. The scandal over dirty waters is just one of the problems facing Rio. Earlier this week, 17 international sporting federations criticized Brazilian authorities for the slow pace of work and a lack of institutional support. Construction work at a purpose-built complex where 8 events will take place has yet to start, and the pace of work at others is slow. Workers have been on strike for a week at the Olympic Park. In spite of the river of bad news, Rio officials maintain everything is under control and the games will be, quote, great. IOC President Thomas Bach, not content with that, is sending a senior troubleshooter to Brazil as part of a series of urgent pressures to tackle the delays. Says Gilbert Feli, the IOC's executive director, is being dispatched to Rio several months earlier than scheduled to help deal with the construction holdups and political paralysis. So it's stopping the gaps and shooting the trouble. And the total cost of building and refurbishing venues for the 2020 Tokyo Olympics will likely more than double to about $3.7 billion, according to an estimate by the Tokyo Metropolitan Government, which will shoulder the cost. The amount is ballooned from the initial estimate. Metropolitan government officials have attributed the rise to a general increase in construction costs caused by high demand for reconstruction work in areas devastated by the 2011 earthquake. That'll never happen again. The Olympics. Yes, it's a movement. And we all need one. Every day. And now, the apologies of the week. Quickly now. Well, just time for some highlights. Dateline Berlin, a German furniture store chain, has apologized for selling coffee mugs featuring faint portraits of Adolf Hitler it mistakenly ordered from a Chinese supplier. The British Library apologized to Middle East Forum founder Daniel Pipes for blocking 2 of his websites on its computers. He's ticked off. The Obama administration has apologized to the government's secret intelligence court for not informing it of existing orders from another federal court to preserve evidence from the NSA's phone record surveillance program, violating the unspoken rule that you don't keep anything secret from the secret court. Vin Scully apologized for an error he made on Tuesday's Dodger game. He made reference to Tigers starter Max Scherzer's brother not knowing that Alex Scherzer had passed away in 2012. Vinny said, last thing we want to do is cause anybody pain. The California Grange has apologized for its treatment of Japanese Americans before and during World War II in a letter to the president of the Japanese American Citizens League. On behalf of the members of the Grange, please accept this letter of apology to the Japanese-American community for a discriminatory period in our history of which we are not proud, said the letter. Designer Alex Perry used Kasi van den Dungen, an extremely thin 21-year-old model, on the runway show at Sydney's Mercedes-Benz Fashion Week Australia. He later apologized for it, describing the decision as a serious lapse of judgment. The former mayor of working-class suburban Los Angeles community Bell apologized in court this week as he and four ex-colleagues agreed to plead no contest to corruption charges that could send him in jail for 4 years. Britain's cooperative banks apologized to customers for screwing up generally. The commissioner of Japanese baseball has apologized after random tests show the official ball is livelier than it should be. The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen, it is a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Ladies and gentlemen, that's going to conclude this week's edition of the show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, the USN 440 cable system at Cham, Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network, up and down the East Coast and North America by the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet, 7.490 megahertz shortwave on the mighty 104 in Berlin, available around the world via the internet at two different locations, live and archived whenever you want it, harryshearer.com and kcsn.org. Available for your smartphone through Stitcher.com and available as a free podcast through WWNO.org, Sideshow Network, SoundCloud, and iTunes. And it'd be just like gluing this piece together if you'd agree to join with me then, all right? Will you? Thank you very much. Show chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Chicago, in exile, and Hawaii desks. Thanks, as always, to Pam Halstead. Thanks to Jenny Lawson here at WWNO in New Orleans for help with today's broadcast and for putting up with those horrible games. The email address for this broadcast and a playlist of the music heard here on available at harryshearer.com, where you can get those Cars I Talk t-shirts before we run out again. Or before you run out. You got someplace to go, right? And I'm on Twitter, at the Harry Shearer. So what? The show comes to you from Century Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of WWNO New Orleans, Louisiana, flagship station of the Change is Easy Radio Network. So long from New Orleans.